Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The legal winds continue to swirl around Missouri school transfers, health care and contraception, and red light cameras. The big players in the digital world and social media, some of whom are pretty good at data mining, complain about government surveillance. Some call that hypocritical. And more than a decade after he was blocked from becoming a federal judge, St. Louis lawyer Ronnie White is getting another chance. I'm Don Marsh. These are just some of the things to talk about with our legal roundtable panel on today's program. With me in studio are attorneys Bill Freivogel, director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale. Mark Smith is associate vice chancellor at Washington University, where he also directs the Career Center. And John Inazu is associate professor of law and political science at Washington University. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us once
again. Thank you.
Thanks. Good morning.
Let me start with you, Bill Freivogel, because this school transfer issue just doesn't seem to go away. I think most of us thought that this had been pretty much resolved when the Missouri Supreme Court ruled in connection with the St. Louis case. Now it's ruled on a Kansas City case, in a Kansas City case.
Right, involving pretty much the same issues that came up in the St. Louis area, whether or not the Missouri law that allows students from unaccredited school districts to transfer to accredited ones, whether that violates the Hancock Amendment. You'll recall the Hancock Amendment was passed a number of actually at this point decades ago, saying that the state couldn't impose new responsibilities on jurisdictions without giving them some money. And, of course, these transfers have involved quite a bit of additional financial expense, particularly for the districts that the students are leaving, because they have to pay for the tuition and some of the transportation. So the Missouri Supreme Court had earlier this year said in the St. Louis that this was not a violation of the Hancock Amendment because there was no new activity being required. It was just a reallocation of educational responsibilities among districts. And what has happened now in the last week is they've applied that same decision to the Kansas City area, where the Kansas City School District is unaccredited. It was a unanimous Missouri Supreme Court decision. Judge Stith, I believe, wrote the opinion.
But if it's essentially the same decision, why does it have to go back to the Supreme Court? I mean, it's the same deal all over again.
You mean why did they have to do it twice?
Yeah.
It was just two separate cases. The Kansas City folks were trying to claim that there were some differences in their case as opposed to the St. Louis one, but the Missouri Supreme Court didn't buy that.
In the news today is a proposal from Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro to establish a statewide school district. That way, she feels apparently that more easily could deal with these situations of unaccredited districts. What would have to happen, Mark? Do you know to make this happen?
Yeah, I don't know. And I hadn't seen that story, but I'm pretty sure we'd have to get some legislation passed. And that's been the kind of central problem with this this Kansas City case and the case that came out of St. Louis, which is the legislature passed this law. It was kind of an unintended consequence, I think, what's happening here. Everyone, the courts have specifically told them, hey, you need to fix this, and then the legislature doesn't. And I think maybe they were waiting, hoping the Supreme Court would say, well, this law doesn't really say that we don't have to allow all these schools, these students to transfer districts and then have somebody pay for them. But now it seems very settled. You've got two Supreme Court cases saying, nope, this law is constitutional, and something's got to happen. It's bankrupting the school districts here in St. Louis. Next school term, we're going to have the Kansas City school system. That's a huge school system. I suspect the surrounding school districts, they've already started grumbling about, we don't want all these students coming. So you have issues of money and race, which are very controversial, but, get people's attention. But there's no easy solution. And so I think the legislature is just going to have to suck it up and really try and come up with something.
I guess the question I would ask is, can the legislature step in and fix it, given the fact that various counties and cities, municipalities, are responsible for their districts?
Well, they can fix this law, which says your students can transfer and then you got to pay for it. They can come up with more money. But, I mean, these school districts are going bankrupt. I think I read that Secretary of Education was going to give some money to one of them, or they were requesting money to keep them out of bankruptcy. That can't go on.
Yeah. I wasn't talking about the legislative fix on the so-called Turner law, the transfer law, but on the establishment of a statewide
district. That would have to go through the legislature too. But like I said, I'm not up to speed on that one.
I mean, you can see why the Kansas City School District is upset. Similarly, you can here in Normandy and in Riverview. But in Kansas City, I believe that they actually met accreditation standards last year, but the State Board of Education said you've got to do it at least another year. And so now the Kansas City District has asked the state officials to at least give them provisional accreditation. That is the reason, for example, that the St. Louis School District was not involved on this side of the state. So there's a lot of pressure on the state education officials. Within the legislature, my understanding of where this is broken down over the past a session or two is that it gets all involved in the whole question of school choice. And so then the legislature gets all hamstrung over that issue, throwing that in together with the issues involved in the transfer.
Interesting thing about this we were talking about is you had a Supreme Court case in 1974, I think it was Milliken versus Bradley, which basically said when you do have these efforts to integrate schools, that you can't bring in suburban school districts unless there's some evidence that they did some bad things in the past. But this is having the effect of being kind of a workaround from that law. So you're now all of a sudden basically if Kansas City is coming into this, all these urban the kids from the urban school district are going to go out to Raytown and Blue Springs and places like all these suburban districts, something that a court couldn't have done, but now it's being done because the legislature probably didn't think through this law they drafted.
Well, they've got about a month before they go back into session, so perhaps
I'm sure they'll hop right on it.
John, any insight from you on this?
Well, a couple things I was thinking of. One, the per student cost per district is a number that gets thrown around a lot, but it seems that we've got to do a lot more policy and analysis on what that number means, the per student cost in St. Louis City, for example, compared to some of the surrounding areas. And that's a number that we can't assume, I think. And then the other question I had, and be interested in your thoughts on this, when and to what extent do vouchers come back into the discussion going forward?
Well, probably the next time the legislature.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very controversial. Yeah. You're going to vouchers. I mean, that's I think what you were talking about, the whole kind
exactly,
of,
yes.
It is. Third rail.
And although this is not really a desegregation case, it is interesting that it comes after a time when St. Louis and Kansas City had the two biggest, most expensive desegregation cases in the country. And St. Louis had the largest student transfer transfer desegregation case of any place in the country. So, this transfer situation, while not related directly to that, comes in two places that have had a lot of history in this area.
Yeah, well, it's quite a story, and obviously it's not going away until somebody or some unit does something about it. Let's move on. I'd like to bring up the case of Ronnie White. I think most people who have been in St. Louis for any length of time are familiar with him. He's a former Supreme Court justice. He's well known. And a little more than 10 years ago, he was appointed to the federal bench but was blocked by then-Senator John Ashcroft, who essentially said that Ronnie White was soft on criminals. I think it was words to that effect, that he was soft on criminals. Well, it looks like Mr. White, now a private attorney in St. Louis, is going to be it has been nominated again. It's yet for the Senate to act on that. It's sort of an interesting case to come back of this sort, Bill.
Yeah, it hardly ever happens that a person who hasn't gotten through gets another chance. I'm not really totally surprised here. And it's interesting that Senator Blunt has said he is not going to try to block
right.
it, which is very important. I think I think I've said this on this program before, although I've never written it myself. I think that John Ashcroft, and I've never talked to John Ashcroft about this, but I believe that John Ashcroft actually regretted that episode. The reason I say that is because I have a friend who witnessed Governor Blunt swearing in, and at that swearing in, apparently this friend of mine, who's also been on this show, witnessed Ashcroft handing a note to Ronnie White and apologizing. or at least saying he regretted the way that it played out. I think that is a little bit of an explanation for how we can come back around to this. And plus, you know, after that really nasty episode where, you know, first Ashcroft blocked White, and then White showed up to testify against Ashcroft, or to testify about his experience Ashcroft Attorney General confirmation hearings. Yeah. I mean, after that, then White, you know, remained on the Supreme Court for a while. He has an additional record as a judge, and now then went off into private practice. So I think he probably has particularly with the filibuster rules having been changed, I think he probably has a pretty good chance.
Yeah, I think so too. I think he'll get through. I mean, like you said, I think the key is Blunt having committed that he won't block him, and so and White came up twice. He was nominated the first time, and then they just didn't act on it, so it died. But then they brought him back 2 years later, I guess Clinton, and they actually had a vote. They didn't even refuse to have the vote, and voted him down, which seemed very mean to me. So he spent time in the Missouri Court of Appeals, Missouri Supreme Court, and then back in private practice. So I think, barring any change of heart, I think this is going to sail through.
Right. Well, you mentioned the new filibuster rule, and that was put into effect this past week, I guess, the last 10 days or so, when Patricia Millett was confirmed to the D.C. Federal Court of Appeals, which had been held up by the potential for a filibuster. So there we go. I think she got 54, 55 votes. Under the previous system, she would have needed 60 to prevent the filibuster, correct? Any thoughts about that part of it?
She's from East St. Louis, Illinois, worked at Aiken Gump most recently, and then worked for a long time in the government and the Solicitor General's office. So she just has all kinds of awards, so I think she'll be very well received.
Very highly regarded.
Yeah.
We ought to also point out that with the discussion going on now concerning the budget, that 60 votes will be needed in the Senate to pass the budget, which the House has already approved, but that's a different deal altogether.
Certainly the change in the filibuster rule has ushered in a really nasty mood in the Senate. You know, these various votes have been delayed by the Republicans, who are very unhappy about the change in the rules. And I think there's no question but that I would be very surprised if the Republicans take control of the Senate. I'm sure they will have this. They will follow what the Democrats just forced upon them.
Yeah, well, the mood in the Senate and on Capitol Hill has been really something to watch for all of us for a good long while now. Let's take a break. We'll do that and come back and talk about the Affordable Care Act, because it's certainly back in the news again, and we will do that when we return. This is our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. With me in studio are Mark Smith from Washington University, John Inazu from Washington University, and Bill Freivogel from SIU in Carbondale. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. With me are attorneys John Inazu from Washington University, Mark Smith, also from Washington University, and Bill Freivogel from SIU in Carbondale. John, I'll turn to you because this is an area I know in which you have a particular expertise, and that is health care, and in particular the Affordable Care Act, which most people are now calling Obamacare. A couple of issues in that making the news. One is the Hobby Lobby case. Why don't we walk through them? Tell us, if you will, what that is all about and what challenge it affords to the Affordable Care Act.
Sure. And one quick clarification. I'm more in the religion than the health area, so I can speak more from the religion side of this. But it's a great case that blends the two areas front and center. And the what makes this such a fascinating case is the number of issues it raises on all sides of the legal questions. So this is a case that arose to mandated contraception coverage under the Affordable Care Act and religious objections to that on a number of fronts, some from Protestants who object to contraception that works on their view as abortifacients, and then some from Catholics that object to all contraception. So now we're seeing at the Supreme Court for-profit commercial businesses bringing these challenges, which is a pretty new thing for us to see in the case law.
And this is Hobby Lobby.
Hobby Lobby, right. And, okay. And Conestoga Woods is another plaintiff that are combined for review now.
Okay. Can you give us a little more detail on the Hobby Lobby case?
So Hobby Lobby, and some people know Hobby Lobby well and others don't, but it's an arts and crafts kind of store. Pretty big presence, 10,000 employees, I think, and around the country. And they're owned by the Green family that has religious objections to the coverage, but also as a profoundly religious family that runs their business, closes it on Sundays, has policies in their hiring about devoting their business to God and these sorts of things. So there's not much of a question about the sincerity of their beliefs here. But that sincere belief comes up into conflict with the contraception coverage that the ACA says needs to be provided. And then there's another interest in the mix, which is the interest of employees of Hobby Lobby who want access to the contraception.
Has the Supreme Court agreed to take this case? Is it definitely on the docket?
It's on the docket, and it's getting a lot of attention. Some high-profile lawyers on both sides of the case and a lot of different parties lining up as amicus for the case.
And are you involved in that? Did I read that you have an amicus brief?
Not in this one. No, I'm sitting this one out.
Okay. There are other cases. The Reed case from our state. The Reed case in Kansas City, which is a car dealer, and Representative Wieland, I guess, is the way it's pronounced.
Right. So in a number of these cases, courts have said, well, you don't have to, which are very similar to the Hobby Lobby kinds of issues, where employers. Who say they have very strong religious beliefs, say that those should keep them from having to follow the requirements of the regulations under the Affordable Care Act. And the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has said they don't have to comply with the law until the Supreme Court answers the question in Hobby Lobby and the Conestoga case. Although they haven't actually taken – last I saw, they hadn't actually taken that step yet in – Representative Wieland's case, but Wieland was asking for there to be a stay.
But they're all essentially the same. Is that correct?
I think they all are. They're all pretty much the same. Like in our area, we have Sharp Holdings, which is Heartland Ministries, American Pulverizer, which is the Grizedek family, and then Frank O'Brien, who's a Catholic employer. And all of them are saying that for religious reasons, like the Hobby Lobby folks, that they do not want to buy health care that funds birth control that might be considered to be abortion related.
But like Wieland is his case is about buying it for kids. He has to buy it for his kids, right?
Kids, yeah.
And as I understand the Hobby Lobby case, it's under that Restoration Freedom Act or whatever, that Clinton era Religious Freedom Act. It's not under the First Amendment, right?
Well, there'll be challenges under both, but the stronger claim than the one the Supreme
Court. I
thought
the Conestoga had both, but the other one does as well?
I think the technical answer is I think that the Supreme Court is looking primarily at the statutory question under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
And so the question there is this, like you said, you have a for-profit corporation. Now, as I understand, a not-for-profit corporation might be treated differently because it's this issue. Is this for-profit corporation a person under this law, right?
Under the law, and that's important, right? It's under the law, not under the Constitution. So we have to look at the statutory language, what went into it, how the court's going to interpret that statute. And there, I think the litigants might have an easier hurdle to overcome on the statutory question because the definition of persons under that law is just a different question than what it means under the First Amendment.
Oh, okay.
What happens to the Affordable Care Act if, in fact, the court holds with Hobby Lobby? I mean, is it dead? Is it just have another critical part ripped out of it?
HHS would just have to come up with new regulations that would better accommodate the religious religious beliefs of these employers.
Right, and that's a key point, right? This is a challenge to the HHS regulation, not to the statute.
Okay, so people are not looking at this in terms of this is it for or against the Affordable Care Act.
But it's another shot at it, and it slows it down and doesn't help. Mm-hmm.
And keeps it in the public mind, needless to say, and the critics.
I would say one thing about whether all these cases are the same or not. There's a sense in which they're all raising very similar legal challenges, but there's also a different sense in which the nature of the particular plaintiffs matters a lot to perception. So Hobby Lobby with 10,000 employees in an arts and crafts store is one thing. A small Bible manufacturer is another thing, and that might matter a great deal to how this thing is spun out in courts and also in the press and elsewhere.
I don't think the Supreme Court would probably want to end up in a position where it was giving Exxon the right to get out of, to assert that they have religious beliefs and their employees don't get to have these kinds of this kind of coverage. So it seems like the court's going to want to try to find some sort of a line to draw between the Exxons and the Hobby Lobbies of the world.
That's the real question, because there's a limiting principle problem in either direction. And on the one – yours is on the one hand, right? We don't want Exxon or the Boeing company to have religious rights in some sense. But on the other hand, if you say these for-profit corporations for whatever reason are not eligible for any kind of religious or free exercise claim, then what do you do about the Bible manufacturer or the very, you know, the small Catholic organization? Yeah.
But given the fact that the way the Supreme Court ruled on Citizens United declaring corporations people, does that come into play in this dialogue at all?
It might, and it's being raised in some of the case law and challenges, but there is a way, and I think a plausible way to distinguish the free speech right in Citizens United that's concerned with listeners and that sort of thing from the free exercise right about the exercise of religion from within the corporate entity.
But I think in the public dialogue, it's going to just get – if the Supreme Court says corporations have religious freedom rights, that then it's just going to get merged with the – you know, the critics of Citizens United will say, look, they've done it again.
They've done it again, right. Yeah.
They'll definitely link there.
While we're on this subject, let's bring in Jerry calling from O'Fallon, who wants to make a comment or ask a question. Jerry, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yes, I have a couple of questions or comments about the – specific topic you're talking about. How does this fit in the realm of a publicly owned company? You know, I'm a shareholder in Boeing. Do I have a say if Boeing decides that they do not want to fund contraception for their employees? And if you take it a step further, what if a company decides that diabetes is actually an indication of a moral failing, of someone not being able to discipline themselves when it comes to their food intake, etc.? And then saying because of moral reasons, we will not pay claims associated with that because it's really it's not our responsibility. And I guess it's kind of almost along the same lines as this debate has gone on about we can't force someone who is against contraception as a pharmacist to issue it, which to me is like saying I want to work at a high-end restaurant, but I don't believe in consuming alcohol, so I want the job, but I don't want to have to serve it. So anyway, thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jerry.
The question about publicly owned or the diabetes, those are great questions that illustrate the same limiting principle problem as the Exxon example. And the real problem is the Supreme Court is going to have to draw a line somewhere. And so maybe it's on publicly owned versus closely held, but that has its problems and might not be satisfactory. But it can't be corporation versus non-corporation because the corporate form extends to other entities like nonprofits, like churches. Churches are corporations. Right. And so there's the limiting principle in the other direction. So there's going to be a line drawing exercise. It's not clear to me how it can be theoretically or constitutionally tight.
Mm-hmm. And what about what he was kind of saying about – so say there's a closely held corporation that is owned by Christian Scientists. Could they somehow say, we don't want to have healthcare at all?
Well, it raises the question because a couple of the preliminary legal questions for any sort of religious freedom challenge are going to be the sincerity of the belief and the substantial nature of the burden, whether it substantially burdens religion. And the courts traditionally have been very leery of probing too deeply into those claims.
They would pass that.
They'd pass the threshold test in most cases, and then you have compelling interest analysis. Yeah. You know, is the state's interest in providing health care such a compelling interest that we force it on them anyway? And that might be where this Hobby Lobby case goes down too, on the question of contraception.
Yeah. One little piece of background that's a little bit interesting. So we're talking really – and correct me if I'm wrong here – but two different religious freedoms, one based in a statute and one based in the First Amendment. So the First Amendment says that everybody has a free exercise of a religion. Then there was a decision, I believe it was Smith versus Oregon back in the 1990s. Justice Scalia actually ironically wrote the decision in which he said that if there's sort of reduced the amount of free exercise freedom when there was a generally applicable law. So, for example, in that case, the question was there were some Indian groups that wanted to smoke peyote as a sacrament. And Scalia said, no, that's a generally applicable law. Nobody gets to smoke peyote. So if we have generally applicable laws, then you don't have a religious freedom claim. So that's why Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that said, you can't substantially – we're going to say as Congress, you can't substantially burden a person's religious freedom. So they sort of raised the bar again for protection of religious freedom.
And then two comments on that point. One, that law was subsequently invalidated as applied to the states, but it still applies to federal law, which is why it's at issue in these cases. And then the second point is that there's going to need to be additional inquiry into the substantial nature of those claims regardless under either standard.
Okay. Well, stay tuned, as we say. Let's move on to another issue that certainly gets a lot of attention, and the Supreme Court is going to hear a case in January on the constitutionality of a Massachusetts law prohibiting pro-life advocates from demonstrating or counseling on sidewalks outside reproductive health care facilities. What's the issue here?
Yeah, this is another great, great case to illustrate the tension of two compelling rights-based concerns. So one is the interest of access to abortion facilities, and the other is free speech rights. And what makes this case, I think, really interesting is that the Massachusetts law prohibits all speech or expression on a public sidewalk outside of the abortion facilities. And so now we have this venue of the public sidewalk that's particularly interesting for First Amendment purposes.
Is there any connection between this and the Westboro Baptist Church situation in which the protesting military funerals?
I think only like very generally, in that the Supreme Court has recognized in the past that there could be some sort of buffer zone around an abortion clinic that would protect, a woman trying to enter the clinic from being approached face to face by a protester. And so sometimes people have said, well, okay, so if you're going to have buffer zones around abortion clinics, then, you know, can't there be buffer zones around funerals for veterans? And as a matter of fact, some of the lower courts have approved, I think, a 100-foot buffer zone around the veterans' funerals. But I think it's very likely. I mean, if I had it, you really shouldn't guess what the Supreme Court's going to do, but I'll do it anyway. I think that they're going to throw out this Massachusetts law. And the reason I think they're going to do that is because the opponents of abortion can't say anything, but the clinic employees can come out and escort the person in,
right,
or say, yeah, really, it's a good idea to just come on in. This is we'll protect you, et cetera. So you cannot have viewpoint discrimination under the First Amendment, and that would seem to amount to viewpoint discrimination.
I mean, that's one way to look at it, but there's also just the question of what the law calls a public forum, and where a traditional public forum like a sidewalk or a park where all kinds of views are allowed, even, the court has said, Westboro Baptist kinds of views. And then what's particularly interesting in this case is the litigants here are not the Westboro Baptists. So they call themselves sidewalk counselors. Their purpose is not to protest abortion. It's to change the minds of people coming into the clinics, and they do so without sort of vitriolic attacks. They're grandmothers and others who go there to pray and talk, and that gives it a quite different perspective than the Westboro Baptists that we know of from other
contexts. So it becomes less like public speech is what you're saying, that this is – so it maybe would receive less protection?
No, not that it would receive less protection, but that it illustrates that the public forum allows for all kinds of speech, including emotionally charged and harmful and mean speech, and this isn't even that.
Right.
So the public forum accommodates for this kind of speech too in most circumstances.
It's Massachusetts law, but the ruling would have national implications because this
wasn't
going,
there a Colorado case
in the country.
That's right.
And this is different from the Colorado case because of what you identified,
Bill,
right?
Well, it's different in the court, and the court is different.
Different, right. Well, that's true.
Kennedy was in dissent in the Colorado case, and I think Kennedy plus the people to his right are likely to.
Because in this Massachusetts case, they've specifically said either it's different or overrule the Colorado case. And the Colorado case said, you know, didn't have this exemption for the employees to come out and talk to the people, as I understand it.
We have another couple of calls relating to this particular issue. Let's get these folks in before we take a break and move on. Ed in St. Louis, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Jerry's call caused me to make me think. I went to St. Louis University, and then after that, down the block from there, I used to give blood at the Red Cross. Right there, within walking distance of where you gentlemen are sitting. And I was just thinking, if a nurse at the Red Cross who used to help us give blood converted to being a Jehovah's Witness and says, I am against blood transfusions, would he be able to just sit there and do nothing because this is against my religious obligations because they don't believe in blood transfusions?
All right, thanks for the call. By the way, related to this, we have a tweet here with the writer objecting to diabetes being used, which was also something the jury brought into the conversation. They said it might be far-fetched, but what about refusing to pay for HIV medications?
Well, some of the court briefs have brought up that very issue of, well, you know, if you can have these objections to the abortifacients, then you could also have objections to HIV or some sort of something else that affects something that affects an embryo. On the other question about the Red Cross nurse who didn't want to do the blood transfusions, I mean, employers have to accommodate their employees' religious beliefs, but I don't think an accommodation would require them to not assign them any work.
All right. Another quickie from Webster Groves. David joins us in this general area. Go ahead, David.
Hi. My question is, if we take the Hobby Lobby case or even the diabetes or HIV treatment and back up 10,000 feet, and, you know, if you have so many corporations who choose what they want to pick and choose, you know, we're willing to pay for this, we're not willing to pay for that, we think these particular things are morally objectionable and we don't think our dollars should be required to fund them, does the corporate community eventually paint itself into the corner of single-payer healthcare that, you know, they might provide some dollar amount for their employees, but basically everyone goes and buys it through the exchange just because it gets too complicated that I'll pay for this and that company will pay for that, but, you know, I don't want to do this and you don't want to do that. I think it creates so many different avenues for objections that at some point it just becomes wholly unworkable and we end up doing it all on our own anyway.
David, thanks for the call. Thoughts, gentlemen?
Well, I think as a practical matter, one of the reasons that the particular Hobby Lobby case sets up the issue well is there just aren't a whole lot of companies making religious claims on the contraception issue. And if you had this case go one way and then a flood of other companies say, well, we object to such and such, then you are going to reintroduce the sincerity question on the front end. But I don't see as a policy matter on a widespread scale of religiously based objections to healthcare particular provisions undoing the legislation.
And the other thing is, this is not a legal issue, but just as a practical matter, most corporations, I think Hobby Lobby is an exception. They pay, as I understand it, they pay their new workers like double the minimum wage because they think it's the Christian thing to do. And they do it because of their religious beliefs, not because of a business motive. But most businesses are about making money. And so, you know, Chick-fil-A suffered, people are boycotted it. I think Dayton, the governor candidate, there was a huge gay backlash because he had given some money to a candidate who was pro-business but also happened to be kind of against gay marriage. And so
Target was in on this.
Yeah, Target, well. Right. Yeah. So I think a lot of these businesses are going to say, we got to stay away from this because we want to make money.
Right. Okay, well, let's let that dog continue to sleep for a moment as we take a break. We're talking with our legal roundtable panel today. Mark Smith is with us. You just heard from him. Bill Freivogel also with us, as is John Anazu. And we'll continue with the conversation. And if you would like to get into it, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us a tweet at STL on air or send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to the Legal Roundtable discussion. I noticed since we last got together, and we've talked about this before, that Creve Coeur has put its red light program on hold. As we discussed last time, there are a lot of municipalities that are having problems with this. Having gone into that, my question really is, could we be heading for a statewide law, or who is going to resolve this thing ultimately? I mean, Creve Coeur is worried about it. Ellisville is worried about it. Other communities are worried about it. It seems that something sort of universal is going to have to be done.
I guess the first possibility would be the Missouri Supreme
Exactly.
Court.
Exactly, yeah, because these were two Court of Appeals opinions, right?
Right. So there was an initial Court of Appeals opinion that upheld one district's red light laws, and then the most recent opinion throughout the red light law, and it was based upon the red light statutes regulate the same activity, conflict basically with a state law, that the red light activity, the red light cameras are local ordinances that regulate the same behavior as the state law against running a red light, but they do it in two different ways. And they can't do it in two different ways. The one different way is they punish the owner of the car rather than the driver. And the second way is that they do not – the local laws do not assess points and the state law does. And so the Court of Appeals said because you have those conflicts and because state law trumps local law, that the local law fails. And so now I think we'll see if that's something that the Missouri Supreme Court agrees with.
And if the Missouri Supreme Court upholds the red law, red light laws, I think you could still have the state legislature making them illegal. But if the Supreme Court says they're not legal, I think it would be very difficult for the legislature to make them legal. I mean, maybe there's some way they could make it a workaround, but I think that would be tough. Not impossible, but tough.
And the legislature, as we well know, sometimes moves a little slowly when it comes to items that are controversial.
There's still that threat of Sharia law, and we got to take care of that. So that'll be number one on their priority list.
I think the veto pen took care of that, but who knows? It might be back. By the way, just backing up a little bit, we have an email here from Kristen, who is a Christian Scientist. And I think Kristen may have misunderstood something Mark said. I think it was Mark. I'd like to respond to the recent comment implying that Christian Scientists do not support health care. That's not quite correct. Christian Scientists certainly do not want to withhold traditional health coverage from people. And she goes on. But that's not what you were saying.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Kristen, but thank you for getting to us. One of the things that I'm sure we'll be hearing about at some point during the remainder of the holiday season is the issue of Christmas displays. We have not really heard anything yet, to my knowledge. Have you guys heard anything about concerns over Christmas displays? Well, John, let me turn to you. When is a Christmas display okay?
Here the Supreme Court of the United States has not given us much help. A number of commentators have reduced the rule to something like the three plastic animals rule. So if you have baby Jesus with Rudolph and Santa and a talking wishing well, then you're okay. But the nativity alone is not.
Okay. So we'll wait and see, I suppose.
Right. And that sort of grows out of – there was a case in Pittsburgh where Pittsburgh had – Allegheny County had on it – it's like main public staircase, they had a crash. And the Supreme Court said that violated the First Amendment because it seemed like an endorsement of religion. But outside, mm-hmm. there was a menorah and a number of other holiday symbols, and that one of the justices switched on that one and said that was okay. So it is it's sort of a difficult line to understand. And with Justice O'Connor was the person who really pushed this so-called endorsement test, that if the government seems to be endorsing religion or a particular religion, that violates the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. And with her gone, that could change.
I think what's interesting in these kinds of cases, and you're right, we haven't heard much about them this season, but they tend to come up pretty regularly, mm-hmm. is that the push for legality or constitutionality is all about dumbing down the significance of the religious symbolism. And that ought to be a concern for almost everyone. And in this way, I think relates to the Town of Greece case that I think you all spoke about in an earlier show, and this is a legislative prayer case out of New York. And the whole thrust of that jurisprudence is if you can say God in a non-sectarian or non-offensive enough way, then it might be okay. And there's a real concern for religious believers here. In the Allegheny case that you were talking about, Bill, the Supreme Court's opinion said that Christmas and Hanukkah are winter festivals, and for that reason they're okay to celebrate. And that should cause profound concern for, I think, everyone.
Well, we'll wait to see if anything more comes up.
Well, this Town of Greece case, because the Supreme Court, this is where they were – the Town of Greece case that John mentioned, they were – they're starting their the legislative hearings with prayers. And so the justices were wrestling with this question and kind of the question you guys mentioned before, which is it's a matter of degree. So how do you have – a non-denominational prayer? How do you have like a non-sectarian prayer? Can you say God? Well, does that upset devil worshipers? I mean, the Supreme Court justices are asking questions like that. So you can tell this is tough stuff for them too. They don't know what to do with it.
I mean, clearly you don't want somebody starting out a legislative session or a city council meeting with some sort of really strong denunciation of anybody who's not a Christian or calling people who are gay and lesbians by some terrible name. So you clearly don't want to get there. But the Supreme Court has previously said in a case called Marsh versus Chambers that a non-denomination that a prayer from a minister paid for by the government could be used to start out the Nebraska legislative session. So clearly that has been permitted.
Well, one thing in this town of Greece, they talked about historical precedent if you've been doing it before, but the Supreme Court justices didn't seem to go for that. And they haven't gone that for that, as I understand, with the public displays. Just because you've always done it that way, it's not good enough. It has to be still multifaceted.
And one reason it might not be good enough is and the Supreme Court's been wrestling with these kinds of cases for decades, but the growing number of atheists in the country present a unique problem because now non-sectarian no longer works. If the word God is in there, that's not going to work. And you have legally you have to be concerned about that audience as well.
Let's go back to the phones. Scott and DeSoto, tell us what you want to talk about.
Yes, sir. I was just curious, thank you, about the transfer laws. And I was curious if you take a child from one school district and send them to another school district, are there tax law implications here? Because you basically have one entity which has the power to raise in the district, and now you're sending it to another tax entity or another government agency, basically. I guess this comes under voucher law, maybe? I don't really understand what's going on here.
So if District A sends students to District B, District A also has to send money to District B.
Well, whose money? The state's money or the tax revenue?
The tax revenue from District A.
Because District B is educating the students and presumably has additional costs.
And District A also has to pay their transportation costs.
So it's legal for
under Missouri law, as it now stands, right?
There's no Hancock implications on this?
Supreme Court says no.
Okay.
Thanks very much for the call. A little bit of a curveball there because I thought Scott was going to talk about this affluenza case. Have you heard about that? Where the young man killed four people in an automobile accident.
This is like the Twinkie defense or something. This kid is going to get a light
probation
because he's affluent and his parents I just saw it on TV briefly.
Exactly.
He's apparently wealthy. He's wealthy. His parents didn't teach him right for wrong, and they just taught him that money could buy his way out of all problems, and so he's going to get probation.
Therefore, he did not understand that the rules applied to him.
You never know what's going on with the facts, but it sounds pretty goofy to me.
But nonetheless, the young man, four dead, nine injured, as I understand
it.
And he's going to a $450,000 a year facility for treatment for 30 days or something.
How
like
old
that.
Is he?
He's a teenager.
Yeah. So it's a juvenile court kind of thing?
Yeah. The judge, by the way, the judge who imposed this sentence, or lack thereof, depending on your point of view, has since been fired.
Oh, really?
There are consequences.
It sounds goofy in this example, but it raises a serious point, which is how do we determine what reasonable behavior is, especially in the criminal law? And that actually raises some pretty difficult questions about how you're raised, background influences, and what kind of accountability we put on different people. In this example, I agree with you, Mark, that it seems pretty out there, but the underlying question is pretty profound, I think.
Well, and it also goes to this recent Missouri execution. This guy, they executed another. But when you read this guy's backstory, I mean, he's a terrible person. He killed this man who stopped to help him, a good Samaritan. But then when you read about this guy's childhood, it was like hellish. And you think, how could you expect this guy to turn out normal? So I don't know what the solution is for something like that. You can't have somebody out in society like that. But when you read about what happened to him when he was young, you think, oh, my God, this guy never had a chance.
Well, a lot of bad things happen to a lot of people when they're young, and they seem to
not like this guy.
This
fellow was his name's Nicholson, and he claimed that he watched his mother shoot up heroin, that she fed him dog food, and that she once put him up to a fight with a Doberman pincher.
That she had men over all the time who would abuse him. He had burns. I mean,
Well, obviously it was a tough start.
It didn't work for him. No. He's dead.
Yeah, right. And another one coming, by the way. Missouri, I think, is getting ready for its third execution. In the time we have left, I want to get your input on this this letter that Google and Twitter and LinkedIn and virtually anybody who's anybody in the high-tech world, the social media world, has written complaining about government surveillance. And the issue here that some people would look at, I suppose, is the fact that these folks are pretty good at data mining themselves and getting a lot of information about us that perhaps we might otherwise not want them to have. Thoughts? John?
There's an interesting question of when a company like Google becomes so quasi-monopolistic that it's almost functionally like the government for some of the basic sorts of things that we do. And so you're right. The contrast starts to break down when we're talking about companies of this magnitude that are embedded in the number of ways they are with most of our lives.
Yeah, I just felt like this was the pot calling the kettle black.
Right.
Because, I mean, who is storing more of our private well, I don't know if it's private. More of our information, our personal information, than Google and all the other, you know, social networks that were signing on to that letter. I mean, they make some good points. So the letter said the NSA and the United States should change its data collection procedures in a way that's more respectful of people's private data, and that is more quote unquote transparent. That word transparent sometimes drives me a little crazy when we're talking about spying, but and that, you know, the United States should not you know, be, as I understood the letter, not really be collecting a lot of this data that's going from country to country. I mean, that has been sort of the basis of U.S. intelligence is that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply outside the country, and so they can collect all that data and mine it and try to find patterns, and then finding patterns, then say, okay, so now we have a good reason to actually look at the content of somebody's communications, and all of this is done under. The looking at the content is done under a court order or under a law passed by Congress and with the presidential authority. So I wasn't too sympathetic.
I also find it kind of disingenuous because it was Google's CEO 4 or 5 years ago who said, when they were getting criticized, said, well, if you don't want your information out there, just don't put it up. I mean, so kind of a cavalier response to the criticism that, and now they're all of a sudden saying to the NSA, well, don't use all this information that we have out there.
If these social networks were really I don't say they're not sincere. I mean, I suppose these people are sincere. But if they really wanted to protect people's data, they would then say that you have to opt in to having your data collected. And they're not going to do that. And you know why they're not going to do that? Because they wouldn't get the data. They want you to have to opt out, which they know people won't do. Or oftentimes won't do.
Yeah, and the data is how they make their money.
Money,
and,
right. Yes. It's all about money, right.
And they make an awful lot of it.
Yeah.
Well, it really reinforces the point that we've talked about here before, and that is there's an awful lot of law that has yet to be written with regard to the high-tech world. I mean, there's so much going on.
Yeah, the technology is just changing so fast, and the law is never good at keeping up with that.
It's moving so quickly. Okay, we've just about come to the end of our time. Any final thought that any of you gentlemen have?
Merry Christmas to everyone.
Can you say
Merry Christmas? We can say that religiously, can't we?
You're the expert. You're a private entity. You can do it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, have a happy holiday season.
Yeah. Happy Hanukkah,
Mark
to
and John and
everyone else,
and Bill Freivogel. Thanks very much for being with us. Our time is up. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with local author Amanda Doyle about wintertime activities in the St. Louis area. And we'll talk with representatives of the Missouri Botanical Garden, Candy Cane Lane, and Steinberg Skating Rink. What's your favorite wintertime activity in St. Louis? Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org and let us know. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.